They rank among the oldest life forms on Earth. They were thriving before oxygen was easy to come by, and they get credit for helping to create the conditions that made humanity possible, the very air that we breathe. But you won't find many thank you notes addressed to blue-green algae. You will find warnings to stay out of waterways where they thrive. Red tides and glowing green rivers are the calling cards of cyanobacteria, and our guest today has studied this toxic, slippery stuff inside and out. He's also taken a long, hard look at how drinking water could be at risk. Dr. Tim Otten is a microbiologist with Oregon State University, and he's on the line with us now. Dr. Tim Otten, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, Emily. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So when we say blue-green algae, what creature or creatures are we referring to?
Sure. So there's a lot of different types of algae in general. Cyanobacteria, blue-green algae, they are true bacteria. So they have a single bacterial chromosome and not a nucleus like other eukaryotic algae have. So tend to be smaller celled and divide by binary fission. So they make duplicates of themselves and they don't require any cross-fertilization.
So they can clone themselves. And what allows this reproduction, which I'm imagining can be pretty prolific, what kind of conditions allow them to reproduce, as I understand, asexually?
Right. So typically warm water, stagnant water, so anything that'll stratify. So if you've ever been swimming in a lake and tried to see how far you can dive down, and then you reach this area in the water where it's all of a sudden quite frigid, that's the thermocline, and so the warm water is less dense and it sits on top. So water bodies that stratify, and the biggest factor is eutrophication, so too much nitrogen and phosphorus loading into our waterways, which is basically what they, because they are, in simple terms, like very small single-celled plants, and so they need nitrogen and phosphorus in order to grow and divide.
So what does eutrophication mean? That's a pretty big word for me this early in the day. What do you mean by that?
Eutrophication is a human-driven process of basically creating conditions that allow algae to grow and reach these bloom magnitudes. And so we typically apply it to specifically meaning nitrogen and phosphorus inputs. So lakes that are eutrophying, they're becoming more productive. They're able to sustain higher plant or algal biomass, and that's because of nutrient pollution.
So the word eutrophication itself, it connotes that it's human-caused, that the success of the algae is because of something that we're doing?
Yeah, so the EU is Greek for people or human, and then trophic, you know, moving up the food web and having to do with photosynthesis.
So are we looking at, when did this word come into our lexicon? Say 150 years ago, did we even have that word?
That's a great question. I'm not exactly sure. I think it's probably been around for a very long time. If you go to the library and dig out an old limnology textbook, I'm sure that it would be in there. But what we do know is that these algal blooms have been occurring throughout history. So some of the great examples of this are from sediment records. Upper Klamath Lake, for example, we know that Aphanizomenon, which is the most common bloom former up there, has been around since at least the 1920s, maybe the late 1800s, based on the sediment record. We also know from Dutch paintings that there's pictures of ships moored in a bay and the water's green, suggesting that there was some sort of algal bloom present at that time. But the problem is we don't have really strong quantitative records over time to really be able to assess just how much has changed due to human impacts and how that's really accelerating the proliferation of some of these bad players.
What kinds of human impacts accelerate what you just called bad players, the algae that can take over a waterway? Right. We'll get to what happens then in a minute here.
Right. So in the open ocean, for example, there's good cyanobacteria that are really important for carbon fixation. They draw down the CO2 from the atmosphere, which is a concern for global warming. So there's the good players, and then there's the bad ones. And those tend to occur not necessarily only in freshwater systems, but that's where we tend to have the most conflict with them due to our needs for drinking water. And so certain genera of cyanobacteria are able to sustain themselves within the water column because they contain gas vesicles within their cells, so they're positively buoyant. So even though wind is mixing and the waves are lapping, they can continue to rise to the surface because that's where the sunlight is. And that allows them to outcompete other beneficial types of algae that the fish and zooplankton and things rely upon. So you have these certain types of cyanobacteria that are buoyant, and they tend to produce compounds that are toxic to mammals and humans, and that's where the conflict comes in. So it's not that they're just in the lake presence-absence. It's that they're able to reach these massive magnitudes, which causes problems for recreating, swimming, boating on the water, but also a big concern is what's getting into the drinking water. And so that's where this conflict really flares up.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I've been warned multiple times this summer about potentially dog murdering, fish killing, all around summer fun ruining blobs, which close a lot of the good swimming spots in Oregon. Mm-hmm. These are the bad players, I'm assuming. Who and how do we keep track of them?
Well, that's what this. So we published a paper recently looking at the health effects and the distribution of cyanobacteria throughout the country. And that goes back to having good monitoring and surveillance systems in place, which, unfortunately, it's sort of a patchwork right now. Each state has, well, if they've opted to, states across the country have some sort of harmful algal bloom program, but a lot of them are underfunded, and about half of the states don't have any harmful algal bloom program at all. And so it's definitely needs to be on people's radar.
So you're saying half of the U.S. states don't even have a harmful algal bloom program. Can we circle back and talk about why we would want to warn people about it? How is it toxic? I think I picked up from you earlier. It's toxic to mammals. Sounds like it's not toxic to fish, but it destroys their habitat. Can you talk a little bit more about, other than mucking up the water, what this algae actually does to us or our pets?
Yeah, so it's a combination of things. There are some algae that produce ichthyotoxins, so toxins that are specifically affect fish. But there's often fish kills that are associated with algal blooms. And that seems to be less due to the toxins themselves and more due to this process where you have all this biomass, all this scum floating on the surface, and if that bloom dies and sinks to the bottom, that's a lot of organic matter. And so due to microbial processes of breaking down that organic matter, it takes the oxygen out of the water. So you end up with dead zones or hypoxic areas. And so if a fish swims into that or a school of fish, they'll tend to asphyxiate, and then you get this big fish kill. So that's one of the ecological effects.
We're talking right now with Dr. Tim Otten of Oregon State University, kind of learning everything you'd want to know about blue-green algae and then some. You can get in your questions here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. I'm Emily Curitan, guest hosting today. Now, Dr. Tim Otten, blue-green algae, it's been around a long time. Should we be more concerned about it now and why?
Yeah, I don't think that the algae has changed. I think it's just the situation is changing. So due to human impacts, the damming of rivers, nutrient overloading due to, fertilizer misuse, overapplying in fields, and then it runs off more impervious surfaces, concrete and things that transfer water and contaminants from the surface, from the land to the water. These are all in global climate change, warmer temperatures, all these things are favoring the growth of these organisms and allowing them to reach these larger bloom magnitudes before they become limited by some factor. So more CO2 in the atmosphere means that they can acquire more carbon so they can continue to grow, more nitrogen and phosphorus in the water, same thing. so we're making it easier for them to reach these magnitudes. And as we alluded to a little bit prior, from a human health effects side, many of these different types of cyanobacteria produce compounds of human health concern. So in addition to dermal skin sorts of and also gastrointestinal concerns, the major concern that we have is with liver toxins. So in certain regions of the world that have really high amounts of cyanobacteria in their drinking water, such as in parts of China, there's very high incidences of liver cancer, much higher than anywhere else in the world. And so epidemiological studies have suggested that some of these are probable tumor promoters and carcinogens. So an acute exposure could lead to liver hemorrhage failure, and a chronic low-dose exposure is implicated in carcinoma. So that's a big concern. The other is dog deaths and things. We know that sometimes a dog swims in the water, rolls around in some scum along the shoreline, and then they end up dying within a few hours, and that's probably due to neurotoxins. So the other major class of compounds that some of these cyanobacteria are able to produce are toxins that interfere with the ability for muscles to either contract or relax, and that's both of those are needed to flex and relax the diaphragm used to breathe. And so if you get exposed to some of these neurotoxins, asphyxiation is a possible outcome.
So it sounds like a terrible way to go for anybody. In your study that you're the lead author on here about the health effects of cyanobacteria in drinking water and recreational water, let's zoom in a little bit on drinking water. How did you get a sense of the role or the contamination that algae might have in our drinking water sources? Where did you look, and how did you look there?
Well, it just comes from experience. You know, I've been working on harmful algal bloom issues for a number of years, and when you go out and spend time on a water body that's impacted and you see just the amount of cells and biomass that these blooms can represent, it's a clear, concern. And so fortunately, in the developed world, such as the United States, there's a lot of different safeguards that are already in place. Even though cyanobacteria monitoring isn't required by the state or the federal government at this time, there are a number of things that utilities do that should be quite effective in lowering the risk of getting a really high dose of toxin into the finished product. And that's one is that the drinking water intake pipes are placed at depth, so below that stratified layer where most of the cells will be present. So you're not taking from the surface where the scum is. So that could be orders of magnitude reduction. And then, there's flocculation of particles, and so you can precipitate out a lot of these other cells. And then the disinfection and just the effects of dilution. So, there's probably 1 to 2 orders of magnitude reduction from what's being measured in the lake versus what's going into the tap. And so our concern is just that each utility is aware of what those reductions look like with their system, because every drinking water utility has a slightly different way of going about their business. And that's one of the concerns raised in this report that you're mentioning now.
So in another enterprise of yours, you actually tracked a bloom across 300 kilometers of the Klamath River. Could we talk more specifically about the Klamath Basin?
Sure.
And that river? What did you learn there?
Well, the Klamath is a really interesting system because at the very top you have Upper Klamath Lake, and that has really large blooms of one type of cyanobacteria that is thought to be non-toxic, and it's actually harvested for nutritional supplements. But there's also a toxic type of algae that is present at times in the lake. And so we also know as you move down the river, there's a series of dams, and behind some of those dams, you get really large blooms of this toxic version. And so one of the questions we had was, what's the source of this toxic strain? Is it coming from above, from Upper Klamath Lake, or does it live year-round? Is it endemic to these reservoirs? And when we see it below the reservoirs, below the dams, moving throughout the river, is that coming directly from the dams, or is it being introduced from other places, or is it growing within the river itself? And so we did using some different genetic tools, we were able to kind of fingerprint that the strains present in the last reservoir, Iron Gate Dam, are the same as that we're seeing throughout the lower reaches of the system, and that those cells are passing through. What was interesting is not that they flow downstream, but that they're able to flow for that distance, 300 kilometers, intact, and reach the Pacific Ocean. And so that raises the question of, people in areas that might not be expecting to see algal blooms need to be aware of, the water quality above them, and that there should be a good dialogue, communication between, from a drinking water perspective at least, if there's a bloom occurring in a reservoir that has an outlet to the river, like most of them do, that people downstream should be aware that they might be seeing some risks. So that was sort of the context of that study.
And the blooms is kind of a conglomeration of these single-celled algae.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of effects do they get downriver, especially as the temperature changes? I would think they like it warm and still, and then they get moving. They cover this 300 kilometers. They don't get carsick or anything like that. They're fine
They're not, as far as we can tell, that's not a healthy environment for them to grow and multiply in. But they are able to just hang tight and survive in those conditions until they hit a slow patch or something, and then they could maybe start to grow again. And so, in that, for the climate, it's really all about the transport. There's no evidence to suggest that there's, cyanobacteria that are growing along the shoreline or within the river itself that are pelagic or buoyant types. There's also types of cyanobacteria that coat the rocks and the benthos, the sediments, and they don't move, and they're more like a carpet, and they can also be toxic. And those are the types that you tend to see in moving waters, are the benthic types of cyanobacteria, and then in lakes and reservoirs you see the scums that form on the surface.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. Tim Otten of Oregon State University about the science behind blue-green algae and the risks it can pose to our drinking water. Dr. Tim Otten, thank you so much for being with us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
My pleasure.